Hi, I'm Illinois Public Media's Lisa Braltz, occasional WILL contributor and permanent space geek. American Experience's Chasing the Moon documentary airs on WILL-TV on July 8th, 9th, and 10th, and is available for streaming in its entirety July 8th. It's 6 glorious hours of space race heaven. The story is told over 3 2-hour installments, beginning with early 20th century rockets, continuing throughout the tumultuous 1960s, and culminating in the first and subsequent moon landings by the United States Apollo program. Though Apollo was mostly about winning the race to the moon, there was also work to be done once we got up there. That's just part of what I talked about with Professors Joaquin Vieira, Charles Gammy, and Brian Fields, all astronomers at the University of Illinois.
I'm Joaquin Vieira. I'm faculty in the astronomy and physics departments here at the University of Illinois.
Hi, I'm Charles Gammy. I'm a professor of astronomy and a professor of physics here at the University of Illinois.
And hi, I'm Brian Fields. I'm also a professor of astronomy and of physics here at Illinois.
So the reason why we're all here today is to talk about the moon in conjunction with the Chasing the Moon documentary, which is out this week on PBS. And I thought it'd be a good idea for us to start with just the moon itself. What is the moon? What is it made of? How did it get to be where it is? Why is it special? So who wants to start?
Sure, I can start a little bit on that. It's made of green cheese. And it's far away.
But not so far that a cow can't jump over it.
Not so. That's right. Okay, now that we've got that out of our system.
Yes.
So it's smaller than the Earth. It's about a quarter of the size of the Earth. And it's about 1/80th of the mass of the Earth. And it's much lower density than the Earth. So about 3/5 the density of the Earth. And it's 60 Earth radii away on average from the Earth. So one of the most obvious features of the moon that we can see, even from outside here in Illinois on a clear night, is that the moon is airless. There's no obvious atmosphere. And that has serious consequences for moon exploration. So that means everybody has to be suited up when they're on the moon. But it also means that things that fall on the moon are not caught by the moon's atmosphere the way things that fall on the Earth are destroyed far up in the Earth's atmosphere. And so even tiny little meteorites fall all the way to the surface of the moon and crumble rocks on the surface of the moon. And that's one of the main processes that governs the evolution of the surface of the moon.
Also evident from the naked eye is that the surface of the moon isn't uniform. So there are light-colored regions and dark-colored regions. In the old days, it was imagined that these dark-colored regions, they look like oceans, so they were called seas, or the Latin term maria. And the light-colored regions, even with just the binoculars, you can see they're sort of mountainous. So you can see the moon is a real world. It's not some undifferentiated thing. And it remained to be understood until we went to the moon what's the reason for these different colors and the different topography. So the light regions, the highlands, are mountainous, and the dark regions, the seas, the maria, are these low-lying, very smooth regions. And so these seas are where we first landed because they're very smooth. And so if you're going to land the first time, you want to pick the safest place possible. And so we picked one of these maria, these seas, namely the Sea of Tranquility.
So how much was known about what the makeup was of the moon before we went up there?
There were a few things known from the way it reflects light. So, for example, it was understood that the surface of the moon was kind of powdery. If it had been smooth, it would have reflected light in a different way. The subsolar point would have been very bright. But instead, the whole face of the moon is approximately equally bright, and that's because it's powdery. It was also known generally what the mass of the moon was and what the density of the moon was. It was understood that that was lower than the Earth.
And both the U.S. and the Soviets had put unmanned landers, robotic landers, on the moon. And in fact, the Soviets had even started to bring back tiny sort of gram-level samples back to the Earth.
Yeah, so I think they tried to bring samples back for the first time during the Apollo 11 mission, and that attempt crash landed on the surface of the moon. But then shortly after that, they sent a robot to the surface of the moon and returned a sample.
So how was the moon created? How did it get into our orbit? What do we know?
I think the short answer to that is that we don't really know. There's a lot of activity in this area right now, but there's kind of a standard story, which is called the giant impact hypothesis. And giant impact hypothesis says that there was a Mars-sized body, about a tenth of the mass of the Earth, that smashed in into the proto-Earth and lofted a ring of debris into orbit around the Earth. And then that ring of debris, which was kind of like Saturn's rings, only made of rock and vapor, condensed to form the moon. And the moon formed very close to the Earth in this picture, and then was pushed away by tidal interactions with the Earth.
Another thing that's important about the moon compared to Earth, and you're kind of alluding to this about there's no air, any impact that hits the moon is there forever. There's no atmosphere. There's no weather. There's no water or rain or wind to wash these features out. So anything that's ever impacted the moon remains there and we see it. And so that's been an important archaeological record for the history of our solar system as well. Just knowing kind of where we came from and what happened in the past and how it maybe wasn't a very hospitable place, you know, a billion years ago or more.
Yeah, and we can say more about that.
4 billion years ago.
And indeed, the footprints, the famous boot prints, the iconic photos that were made 50 years ago, as Joaquin was saying, those will remain essentially forever until they're finally or randomly bombarded by meteorites, but they will be there for millions of years.
That's why the flag doesn't wave, man.
Yeah, so you see these craters on the surface of the moon, and if you can date the craters, which is something that Apollo really helped with, then you can figure out how much junk was in orbit in the early solar system to hit the moon, as a function of time. So was there a lot of stuff floating around early in the solar system? Yes, there were big impacts, big old impacts, and then that tailed off as the solar system got older.
Another thing that we kind of touched on, the moon appears to be very unique, certainly in the solar system and maybe even in our whole galaxy or the universe, in the sense that the ratio of masses, the moon is quite large compared to the Earth for a satellite. If you look around the rest of the solar system, there are typically always moons or often moons or satellites, but they're tiny in comparison to the planet that they're orbiting around. And so a question is that special? Or just a coincidence? Like maybe, for instance, the moon some thought is that it shielded us from impacts, right?
Yeah.
Or deflected them or something.
Yeah, and stabilizes the spin of the Earth.
And another really strange coincidence is that the angular diameter of the moon is effectively exactly the same as the angular diameter of the sun, which is also very unique, not only in our solar system, but possibly the galaxy. And what that means is that you can have total solar eclipses where the moon can completely eclipse the light of the sun. And, you know, that's just kind of an amazing coincidence that, you know, a solar eclipse is maybe something that you can only see from Earth, like in the whole galaxy, which is weird.
It's kind of mind-blowing.
It kind of blows your mind.
And those total eclipses are going to go away because the moon is receding from the Earth. And so it'll block out less and less of the sun over time. And eventually there will be a last total solar eclipse.
I'm making the tears sign. Yes. Here. I guess I knew that. How far into the future is that?
Billions of years.
And maybe this is a good time to say, how do we know that the moon is moving away from us?
Sure.
And we have Apollo to thank for that. Including Apollo 11, the very first landing, there were only a handful of scientific experiments they brought with them, and one of those experiments was essentially a fancy version of a corner mirror. The fancy name is the laser ranging retroreflector, but it just means a corner mirror. And the nature of a corner mirror is you shine light on it, and it comes straight back at you. And so knowing this, such a device was carefully designed and placed on the moon so that, with the express purpose, that we can shine a laser at the moon, and then the light gets reflected straight back by this corner mirror and comes back to the Earth. Now, much of this light is lost. Even a tight laser beam is several kilometers wide when it hits the moon and bounces back to us, and a tiny fraction of that light comes back. But with clever instrumentation, we can measure that light and time it very accurately to get an exceedingly precise distance to the moon and monitor how that distance changes with time.
When was the laser invented again?
Early 60s. So that original work was done at Lick, Lick Observatory. And now it's done at Côte d'Azur, an observatory at Côte d'Azur,
in
France, and also at Apache Point in New Mexico.
And that turned out to be an incredibly fertile experiment because it's taught us many things, indeed more things than we originally expected. But the most important is by monitoring the distance of the moon over time, what we find is that, in fact, the moon is indeed moving away from us, as was hypothesized before the measurement was made. But this verified that indeed that's the case. And the moon moves a little under 2 inches a year away from us every year.
Steadily. 3.8 centimeters per year.
There we go.
And it's...
That doesn't sound like much.
But over time, it can add up. So the moon is about 38 billion centimeters away. And so if you divide the distance by the rate at which it's receding, you get a time for it to be back at the Earth, and that's about 10 billion years, which is comparable to the age of the Earth-Moon system, which is about 4.5 billion years.
And so that's already a hint that the Earth and moon were once together. It's a hint towards this idea that the moon was formed in a giant impact.
Do you know anything about the training of the astronauts to carry out these experiments? To the best of my knowledge, at least in the first few missions to the moon, when we landed on the moon, the gentlemen, the astronauts who went up there were not scientists. They were pilots and astronauts and engineers, but they were not necessarily familiar with what they were being asked to do. Now, in this paper that I read that I was speaking of earlier, the person who wrote it was just amazed at how efficient they were, how able they were to deploy these experiments. And I don't know how much you know about that, but I'd be curious to know, like, what. So if you had an experiment and you had a bunch of people taking it up there, what would that relationship be like?
Well, first of all, these were like the most highly trained people on the planet. So in terms of like somebody capable of following instructions and carrying out some like implementing a plan, I think these were the most capable people, like maybe even in the history of humanity.
But no, I mean, they, you know, think about that trip, right? It's not like you're getting 8 hours of sleep. You're in a cramped little vessel. Then you're dropped into the most inhospitable place humans have ever been in a clunky suit where you can't really use your hands. You're breathing through a thing. You don't have a real full peripheral vision. You know, looming over you is the threat of death, never going back home.
At all
and,
times.
Yeah. And you're supposed to like go get some f-ing rock samples for some dude back on, you know, like, I think that's crazy. Like, you know, you're out there and then you got to do these tasks like for somebody else and imagine that. So the fact that they did everything is pretty incredible.
They did get a lot of training from geologists. So as I understand it, every single one of the astronauts who walked on the moon up until Harrison Schmitt on Apollo 17 was a military pilot. And then Harrison Schmitt was a geologist. He was a Harvard-trained geologist. And he later became a U.S. senator from New Mexico. And so far, Schmitt is the only geologist to have ever walked on another world.
So the geologist walking on the moon was one of the kind of one legitimate reasons scientifically to send actual people there, right? Because, you know, most of the, you know, just getting there, okay, well, you could send a robot. And sample returns, well, you could send a robot. But the one
I'm pretty sure the one legitimate argument for why do you need a man on the moon or a person on the moon was that you could make spontaneous decisions and use your intuition for what to look at, what to take back. And so, you know, otherwise it's just kind of a jingoistic pursuit, right?
The great thing about the Apollo mission, because it was man, because there were human beings that went, we have firsthand descriptions of the surface of another planet. And a famous one is Buzz Aldrin, as he stepped out, as he became the second human being to walk on the moon, the phrase he used was magnificent desolation. So the moon is, when you see pictures from the surface of the moon, it looks like black and white until you see the flag on the uniforms and you realize the moon itself is literally just shades of gray. And it's sterile. There is no life, certainly. There's no water on the surface of the moon. And that's in part because the surface of the moon suffers wild day-night temperature swings of more than 100 degrees. There's no atmosphere to block the not only incoming and falling meteorites, but there's also no atmosphere to block the solar ultraviolet radiation, so that's very harsh. And there's no atmosphere to block high-energy particles from space, which are called cosmic rays. So it's a very inhospitable environment. So it's a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. And so because we had people there, we brought back samples and in the form of rocks and pebbles, dust, the soil, what's called the regolith of the moon, core samples. And in total, this was 842 pounds gathered over six landings. And the beauty of that is we could then bring them back to the lab and study them in exquisite detail. And what we find is the moon is made of the same elements of the Earth. That is to say, the atoms on the moon are the same varieties of atoms we have on the Earth, because, in fact, those atoms are the same atoms everywhere in the cosmos. But not only, of course, is it the same atoms, but they come in similar abundances and combinations, in the similar minerals. But if you drill down in more detail, the composition, the mix of elements on the moon varies with location. And roughly speaking, the mountainous light-colored highlands you can see with your eye have similar composition to the continents on Earth, which in fact are some of the lightest of the rocky elements on Earth. But the dark, low-lying seas, the maria, are made of volcanic material, denser, heavier volcanic material. Which we believe, in fact, came from bombardment of the moon that launched lava flows that then, in the lower lunar gravity, spread over large portions of the surface of the moon, at least on our side of the moon.
So was there a particular mission that had a really standout experiment that, like, people still talk about today, or that this where the science is still being used today, or we're still gathering information? Have you mentioned it already with the measurements, you know, of the moon receding from Earth?
So Apollo 11, Apollo 14, and Apollo 15 all carried these laser reflectors, and those are still being used today. Most of that 842 pounds of rock are still at the Space Flight Center in Houston. And they are still being doled out for laboratory experiments. So it's become possible, even more possible in the last 10 or 15 years, to measure the abundances of individual atoms with exquisite sensitivity. Yeah, so there were seven missions to the moon. And they changed character a little bit over the course of the Apollo program. So they started out very exploratory, you know, very just touchdown. Apollo 11 was about 2 hours with the guys outside on the surface, and then maybe 20 hours on the surface of the moon. And then as time went on, people got more ambitious. And the last three missions had this little buggy that the astronauts used to drive around on the surface of the Earth. And in those missions, astronauts spent almost an entire day outside on the surface of the moon. So those missions brought back a lot more rocks, hundreds of pounds of rocks, as opposed to 48 pounds on Apollo 11. And they had more ambitious experiments.
Let's talk about how the Apollo missions influenced or informed future landings, like on Mars, for example, like Viking, or any of these other missions going out and finding information. Did Apollo have an influence on those, even though we weren't sending people? Was there information that was gathered?
That was on my list of questions, but I didn't really know what to say about that.
Okay. We don't have to talk about it.
Because most of the other missions were robotic.
Mm-hmm, right.
Which is a pretty different ball game.
Well, but I think it told us it's really hard to send humans.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to send robots. And so, you know, I think that is the answer, that after that one, as we were exploring the solar system, and you look at the, right after Apollo, we developed all this technology to send massive things to space rocks. And right after that was Pioneer and the Voyager. We sent Viking to the mission for Viking, which went to Mars, was to look for life, right? It wasn't to go explore the conditions of water or something like that. It was to go look for life. Didn't see any, but, that was a possibility. We could have gone to Mars, sent a robot, and found life. And it's kind of amazing that, you know, when you think about it, though, to enable that, we had to develop all this technology to get there. And if it weren't for the human spaceflight program, maybe we wouldn't have done that, right? There wouldn't have been the, you wouldn't have needed to develop the capability to send such massive things to such great distances if it weren't for the humans.
So I wanted to say a bit about serendipity and surprise connections. So one of the things I find most beautiful in science is the interconnectedness of all the areas of science. And these links are profound, and they're often unexpected and surprising. And some of the most amazing results that we have in science come from stumbling upon links between seemingly unrelated topics. And the Apollo story is full of examples of this. So using the samples that we recovered, the experiments that we left there, and the data that we gathered all 50 years ago on a sterile world, there were and continue to be important advances in seemingly unrelated areas. These include cosmology, Einstein's general relativity theory, the matter versus antimatter makeup of the cosmos, and the detection of debris from massive star explosions, that is a supernova near the Earth millions of years ago. And so to follow up on that last point, as we were saying, the lunar samples remain in NASA's control and are slowly doled out for new experiments with better technology answering new questions. And in my own research, we've amazingly found that there's very good evidence on Earth that there was a star that exploded near us, a supernova, that literally rained its debris upon the Earth that was collected on the ocean floor and recovered. And if that story is true, then there ought to be the same debris on the Moon. And just a few years ago, lunar samples were studied with some amazingly precise measurements and indeed confirmed that the same supernova debris is also on the Moon. And so the science sort of harvest of Apollo continues and will continue.
For Illinois Public Media, I'm Lisa Braltz.